From the plight of bees to algae blooms to playing music for fish, a University of Utah experimental physicist has been covering all these issues that affect the Gem State. Kevin Davenport is a PhD candidate, and he's been spending his summer here in Idaho as a fellow at the Idaho Statesman, focusing his writing on science. And he joins me live in studio today to talk about his career and his time covering these issues that affect Idahoans. Welcome to the program, Kevin.
Thanks. Great to be here.
Tell me about a little bit of your background and how you ended up as a fellow at the Idaho Statesman.
Sure. So I'm currently on a fellowship from the AAAS, the American Association for the Advancement of Science, a fellowship that's called the Mass Media in Science and Engineering. And the point of the fellowship is to take scientists who are interested in science communication, which is critically vital in our society now, and train them, but with some journalism skills, and then put them into various media outlets. There's 26 of us in this cohort, and we're scattered across the nation.
So what's it been like for you to be on the other side, you know, with the media and being a journalist and finding stories and writing stories?
It's been fantastic. I must say that it's on some levels very similar to actually doing science, right? I mean, there's a lot of kind of you have to quickly dig down and become kind of a topical expert on something and then be able to communicate that, which is very similar to what I do professionally as a scientist. So
and communicate it in a way that people understand.
Yes, absolutely.
Right?
Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah, that's the critical part.
One of the stories I thought was really fascinating were the honeybees that are on the roof of Whole Foods in Boise. Tell me about that story, because they're really is a critical need for space like this for bees.
Yeah, that's right. Bees are really having a problem, all types of bees, not just honeybees, wild bees as well, right? So this particular project was incepted by Elika Hall, who is the receiver and Green Mission rep for the Whole Foods, as well as Patty Matthews, who is one of the co-owners of the Matthews Family Farm in Weezer. And they were just interested in doing something to kind of give back to the environment, right? Elika was really interested in having some sort of bees, you know, the different Whole Foods. So sometimes they'll have like a garden on the roof or something like that. And this particular Whole Foods location didn't have the structure for that. So what could they do? Well, they can put a few bees up on the roof and see what they can do with that.
And what did you find that they are doing? Because they just started this
June. A few weeks ago. Yeah. Well, so at this point, they're just kind of at the very initial stages of establishing the hives, which are doing very well, and then, you know, building the population. So at the end of the year, they can gather honey and then figure out what to do with that particular honey. But the important thing about it really is kind of giving the bees a kind of a central urban location. Honeybees have a flight range of a few miles. And so having a location kind of right downtown gives them kind of a waypoint where they can, you know, spread out and go to the park that's nearby and various other places.
And for people who haven't been covering up the plight with bees, tell us a little bit about really the importance of having something like this.
Yeah, sure. So the particular problems, bee populations across the board are kind of really declining. There's, you would expect a kind of a natural die-off over winter anyway, which always happens, but that has been increased for a variety of reasons. Nictinonoid pesticides are one of those reasons. In Idaho specifically, one of the biggest problems are what are called varroa mites, small mites that feed off of the hemolymph, which is the blood of adult bees. They weaken them, and then they can't fly very well. They can't provide the nourishment that the hive needs, and it leads. It's one of the factors that contributes to something that's called colony collapse syndrome.
Okay.
Yeah.
And that's what we're running into.
Yeah, absolutely.
So then there's this whole idea with Yellowstone, and we've got these giant magmas, and we're hearing that it's all going to explode soon, and there's to be an earthquake, and the humans as we know it will no longer exist in this area of the country. Is that true? But B, there is a large magma.
And, sure, yeah.
And there is a science behind why you would research this.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, Yellowstone is a volcanic caldera, right? It's a very large caldera, and it erupts on the frequency of, you know, several hundred thousand years. When geologists say that eruption is imminent, what they mean is it could blow up in, say, the next 200,000 years or something like that.
Okay.
So it's not like we need to, you know.
We shouldn't pack our bags yet?
Like this kind of Hollywood movie scenario is not really what we need to worry about. But what this particular study did is various researchers, Jerry Fairley at the University of Idaho was one of the researchers on this. They came up with a new novel way to understand the rate at which the magma was building up underneath Yellowstone and have discovered that, in fact, the magma is recharging about twice as fast as they thought. And so that kind of changes the way that they, you know, the prediction of models. The more interesting thing is the method that they came up with this. It involves adding a radioactive, an isotope of water that's called heavy water. So you have, instead of the normal hydrogen that you would have in the H2O, you replace the hydrogen with an isotope called deuterium that you can easily differentiate from normal water. And then what they'll do is they'll put this into the like the geysers and the hot springs, and they can track how long it takes for it to decay, and it gives them a much more accurate picture of how heat is being distributed through the Yellowstone caldera.
Oh, interesting.
And it has a lot of really fascinating applications. The main thing that we reported on in the piece is applications for geothermal power. Idaho is fantastically rich.
We have so much of it.
Absolutely, and it's very little of it is tapped. And if you want to explore a site for geothermal power, you have to go through a costly procedure of drilling into the ground.
But now you can just take this little drop of water, basically?
Potentially, yeah. You can use this to kind of, you know, put it into the naturally – there's going to be a hot spring at a geothermal plant or a geothermal site, something like that. You can use this non-invasive technique to maybe figure out, you know, test the efficacy for geothermal power at much lower cost.
And let's talk about you call it the Symphony of the Salmon.
Yes.
This is fascinating. So it is playing music basically for fish, but it helps with research.
Yeah, absolutely. This is probably the most interesting thing that I've reported on here so far. It turns out that, most creatures, most vertebrates, we have stones in our ears that are called otoliths. Humans have them as well, but they don't work nearly the same way as fish. But so in the inner ear, they have these small stones, and over their life, they'll lay down layers of a material called calcium carbonate, which is the same kind of thing that pearls are made out of,
or
the shells of sea creatures, things like that. And that calcium carbonate has a chemical signature based on where, you know, in a river or which river they happen to be in. So scientists have for a long time used these otoliths to basically track the ages of fish. You can slice them open and you can read them like tree rings. And so you know
how old they are based on
absolutely. So what these researchers did, the lead author on this was Jens Hegg at the University of Idaho, and they, instead of just reading the tree rings, you know, in these stones, they analyzed the chemical composition of the rings and then worked with composers at Eastern Washington University, attributed particular musical tones to the different isotopes so that they could play the data instead of viewing the data. If you're really interested in how fish are migrating, then you need a lot of data. You need not only a large amount of data per fish, but you need a lot of fish, right? Like maybe 100, 200 fish. If you try to put that on a visual graph, your brain overloads and you can't read. But you can hear, for instance, if you listen to a symphony, you can tell if one instrument is out of tune. Your ears are much better at differentiating these sounds than your eyes are pulling graphs apart. And so that was the purpose of the study, is you can if you listen to this sound, you can hear when fish are in one river versus the other river, or when they go into the ocean, and it gives you a different way of interpreting the data that has a lot of potential. It's something that's called sonification.
And it really does sound like music.
It really does sound like music. Yeah, if you actually listen to it and the story, we have a link to the to some audio, And it sounds a lot like kind of those like crystal chakra bowls that you rub. It's very soothing. You could probably meditate to the fish.
So what's next for you? Because you're here until the end of August on this part of the fellowship.
Yeah, that's right.
But you are also a PhD candidate. So what's in your future?
Yeah, well, after this is over, which will be the end of August, as you say, then I'll go back to the University of Utah and continue working on my PhD work. Hopefully I'll have about another year before I graduate. And then I'm very interested in doing teaching in science communication. That's why I'm in this fellowship in the first place. So I'll continue to write, you know, doing freelance things, and then explore other options after that.
So what did you think about the media world? Any interest in A, staying with it, or what's your takeaway from being in there?
It's fascinating. I mean, as a scientist, if I stay in academia or just in the science world, it's critically important for us to understand how the media works so that we can communicate our ideas. But the converse is also true. It's important for the media to understand how scientists mm-hmm. work so that, you know, they can more accurately ask us what we're doing and building these bridges of communication. So I think that's really important.
Well, I've really enjoyed the stories that you've been covering, and I hope you're going to cover a couple more before you
head
out of town.
There's many more in the queue.
All right. Well, Kevin, thank you so much. My guest today has been Kevin Davenport. He's a physicist and a fellow at the Idaho Statesman this summer. You can find all of his stories online at the Idaho Statesman. Thanks so much, Kevin, for coming in.
Thank you.